Pressman Fuentes. It's November 23rd, 1993, and we're talking about the early years at the EEOC and her connections and forming alliances with other women interested in Title VII's ban on sex discrimination. So you were discussing...
Yeah, Tina Hobson was working in the Civil Service Commission, the Federal Women's Program. Initially, another woman there was Evelyn Harrison, and I didn't feel she was sympathetic, but Tina was. So it's myself and Tina and Catherine and Mary. And then somewhere along the line, this guy, Phineas Indritz, came in, who's a very special person. He worked up on the Hill. And he got involved, and he's been fighting for civil rights forever. And then there was a woman named Carruthers Berger, who I think was in the Labor Department, and Morag Simchak, who was in the Labor Department.
She was sympathetic with
Dr. all these women, yeah.
Okay, so and Simchak was from a union background, if I remember. She was with the rubber workers.
I don't remember Morag. She had something to do with being Polish or something like that.
Yeah.
Either she or her husband. I can't remember. She's been dead a good many years.
Yes. Was Esther Peterson interested in any of this at this time?
No. And Esther Peterson worked behind the stages to get sex taken out of Title VII before it was passed.
Right. She's mentioned that in other interviews and sort of confessed to that fact and said that she realizes it was a mistake.
I'm interested to hear that because she's not a heroine of mine for that reason, even though she's done all kinds of other fantastic things.
Yeah.
But I know she worked to get Title VII, get sex out of Title VII.
Were the labor people, you mentioned Herb Hammerman, were those, they were in the EEOC at this time, what was their position in all of this?
I think Herb and Marv Rogoff were sympathetic to this, but I really don't have much of a recollection on that. But you asked me about somebody else and I just had a thought. Who did you mention just now before?
Simchak and Peterson, and I mentioned Ellickson a couple of minutes back.
No, I don't know.
Trying to remember what other labor people were.
Oh, labor, that's right. So also, the first union that I remember being involved was the UAW,
okay.
Women's Division, and the very first speech I ever gave in my life, they asked me to come to Chicago and give a speech, and this would have been in maybe December 65, 66 or something. That was the very first speech I ever gave, was at the request of the UAW.
Do you remember what it was on, or...?
Yeah, the early speeches I gave were what Title VII was about, okay. What it meant, what it required, that kind of thing.
Okay. Were they were people like Ann Draper? She was in the
No, I the woman that I worked most closely with and became closest to was a woman named Cele Carrigan, C E L E, C A R R I G A N, and also Dottie Hayner with her.
Okay. Do you sense within the labor movement at this time that? Some unions were for Title VII's enforcement vigorously, and others were less. I mean, could you?
Most were against.
Okay.
Most were against. Another one that I think was sympathetic was the IUE.
Okay.
And I heard something about the chemical workers, but I wasn't involved in it myself. And they were against it for a number of reasons. I think largely because most of their members were men. And if they did for women, one labor union guy even told me that while he was sympathetic, if they did anything for women, they'd be voted out of office in the next election because the men would lose jobs, they thought. By and large, except for these exceptions, the labor unions, to my knowledge, but in the stewardess cases, the labor unions were on the side of the stewardesses.
Okay.
But other than those, what I've mentioned to you, that I've mentioned to you, my feeling is they were unsympathetic.
Were there are the regular unions, the constituent unions of the AFL-CIO. I know some are independent of them. And then there's the actual AFL-CIO federation with George Meany in charge. Did you sense that there were differences?
I can't answer that. I didn't deal with it.
I suppose we should spend a couple minutes on the packing house workers. I know that you were involved at least in the early stages of their complaints. Maybe I should just leave it an open-ended question. What do you remember about that, and what was that issue?
Okay, I remember little, but I found papers that I wrote at the time about it. So I'm going to let you borrow those papers and return them to me.
Okay.
All I remember is that I went out to Waterloo, Iowa, with a guy named Ken Holbert. who at some point at the OC was director of conciliations. And we went out to Waterloo, Iowa, and we investigated that case. And it was the ABC, you know, job categories, which I recognized when I read your law review article. I remember the ABC business. I remember going into the, it was Rath Packing Company that we investigated, just that particular company. Right. And I remember going into the plant and just being horrified at not at the discrimination against women, but at the kinds of jobs women were doing and men were doing. You know, I walked out of there and I said, I'm not going to be able to eat meat for 2 weeks. And I remember one woman was doing something where she was pulling the intestines, these thin intestines she was pulling. Right. And I remember that she said at night when she slept, she dreamt that she was pulling those intestines. Mm-hmm. And they worked in, I don't know, it was just awful conditions. And there was this killing area. And they said women didn't work there. And I remember returning and recommending to Steve Shulman that he not approve the ABC agreement.
Because?
I can't remember. I must have felt that it was sex segregation. I cannot remember.
Okay.
I also remember his, we were in his office, he was the chairman, and I remember his saying something to me which indicated that he understood what I was saying, he was almost sympathetic with what I was saying, but he was going to approve it.
Okay. When you were in Waterloo, did you have a chance to talk to any, do you remember talking to any rank and file members, or were you more, talk to the employers, management personnel, and some union officers? There were probably so many cases, and it was a while ago that it was...
No, I just remember going to the plant. I remember Ken and I had rooms at a motel, and I think a union person came, if I'm correct, came to that motel to be interviewed by us.
Okay.
But that's all I can remember.
Do you remember any, so despite your opinion, they approved this ABC system?
Steve Shulman approved it.
Do you remember any other unions where this happened, where a system like an ABC system?
No.
Okay.
No.
Any other early cases that sort of stick out, if not with the packing house workers, with other unions? That
well, with unions? Well, I told you the stewardess case. It was a big thing, went on for years.
Right.
And the unions were on the side of what I consider right. They were on the side of the stewardesses. Mm-hmm. No, not offhand.
One of the big issues at the EEOC at this time is, I don't know how to frame this kind of question. It's a big question, but it has to do with moving from the notion that individuals being directly discriminated for obvious reasons was bad and illegal, but there were other larger issues about keeping data on women and African Americans being discriminated against, and what eventually led to indirect forms of discrimination, structural forms of discrimination. I don't know if that question makes any sense.
Yeah. A couple of things came to mind as you were talking. Well, some of this started with the research function, you know, with the business of keeping records and asking people, that whole business of keeping records on people by race that was very controversial. We needed to do it for statistics. You know, the forms that employers had to fill out is what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Employers had to complete these forms, and it was a big question in the early days. Well, here we're trying to get away from discrimination. On the other hand, we're asking employers to keep track of who they hire and promote by terms of race and sex and everything. So that was a big issue, but it was resolved that it was more important to have the statistical information. Not in the very early days, but somewhere along the line, we got into this business of the class action suits and the pattern and practice, and it was more important to look at the big picture. And a guy I give a lot of credit for in that connection was a guy named David Copus, who's in private practice here in Washington.
Oh.
Oddly enough, he went over on the management side, a complete switch. This guy was a raving radical. and left the commission and the working for management. But he was the one that conceived of the AT&T suit. You know, the idea of, he went into a rape proceeding and said, I think it was Virginia, Power Electric or something, or Pepco, I don't know, went into the rape proceeding with this, what sounded like a cockamamie theory, that you shouldn't give a rate increase to a company that's discriminating on the basis of race.
It was unknown at that time to...
Sure, who'd ever heard of such a thing? And that's what opened up the whole AT&T case and the revolutionized AT&T.
Was there a, the support for the idea that we have to start keeping data on larger patterns of discrimination?
Well, that's not data on larger patterns of discrimination. What I'm talking about is getting the EO1 forms.
Oh, okay.
You know, and analyzing them and so on. That was fairly early, getting that kind of information.
And it was generally...
And then, as I mentioned, I wrote this paper on the use of statistics in Title VII cases. And I pointed out, and that was at some point along the line accepted, although not initially. It's still, I think, a matter of dispute in the courts. The idea that, if you have an individual case of discrimination, it's very hard to prove it very often. You come in, you say the employer said he didn't hire me because I'm black, and he says I didn't say that, and how do you know who's telling the truth?
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at statistics, if you can look at statistics of the employer's workforce, I'm talking about a single
mm-hmm.
employer, and you see that he has 3,000 people and not one of them is black, that's very telling. I'm not really dealing with your question.
I'm not on a fishing expedition, but I left it open-ended because I'm still trying to understand the movement at this time to develop eventually what would become affirmative action programs. It seems like this is an important period.
So we started with keeping getting EO1 forms.
Okay.
And then we start to look at the data that was in them. And then the other thing that happened was, just about the time I was leaving the EOC in 73, there were some studies done which were depressing because they showed that where a company had charges filed against it, and I'm thinking this even included class action charges,
mm-hmm.
and they conciliated them, that they really didn't change the way they did business very much after.
There wasn't enough teeth in the...
No, they would make a settlement,
uh-huh.
you know, and settle this particular question or case, and then go on like they had before. Now, AT&T, as I said, really changed the way it did business. But this did not always happen.
Okay, the AT&T cases, that's finally decided in the early 70s, no? Is that...
I don't know when.
Okay.
I
want to come back to the EEOC
okay.
in a couple minutes, but at the same time, we have the formation of something known as NOW.
Right.
Would you care to
yes.
comment about how this
yeah.
is how this is going on?
I'll tell you how that happened. So I was working at the EEOC, and I was frustrated because I was waging this one-woman battle. Now, I'm telling you that there were other commissioners who were sympathetic, but I wasn't on a level with them.
Okay.
I mean, I knew them, but they were much higher than I. So I was basically alone in this thing, to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, other people were doing it, but I didn't know.
Okay,
so this woman starts to come around, and it was Betty Friedan. And she had written, some years earlier, The Feminine Mystique. And, you know, reporters are always looking for conflict. And so she started coming around the EOC. She was writing a second book. And she came to interview my boss, Charlie Duncan, and the deputy, Dick Burke, about what was going on in the EOC for women and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And she saw me there, so she would always say, what's the conflict here? What's going, you know, who doesn't like
sure.
What are conflicts is what she was really looking for.
A scoop.
Well, not a scoop, but controversy.
Okay.
So I never responded to her because I was afraid for my job. How could I tell her what was going on there? I thought I would lose my job, so I always said nothing to her. But maybe the third time she came around, I was so frustrated that I took her into my office and I began to cry. And I said to her, what this country needs is an organization for women like the NAACP is for, that time was called Blacks or Negroes.
Mm-hmm.
And she has credited me with giving her that idea in an article she wrote for the New York Times that I have downstairs in 74, I think, 72, 74. I've heard from others, though, who say that other people made similar suggestions to her. I don't know. She was in the position to do something about it because she worked for the government. You know, she was going around the country, she's a writer, so she could say and do things that we couldn't. So then the other thing that happened that was a stimulus for it was There was a meeting of the commissions, the state commissions on the status of women. I was not present there. And Betty Friedan was there and other women were there. And they had heard that Dick Graham was not going to be reappointed as a commissioner because he was favorable to women's rights. Okay. So at that meeting on the commissions on the status of women, and this is all spelled out in Betty Friedan's book called It Changed My Life. At that meeting, the women wanted to pass a resolution that they wanted Dick Graham reappointed. And they were told that they had no authority to pass a resolution. Because these commissions on status of women had some kind of maybe government connection. I don't know because I was not in those commissions. So the women got mad. And Betty Friedan called a meeting in her hotel room. And every woman put in like $5. And they created a war chest, and they wrote out, Betty wrote out on a napkin, to create an organization to bring women into the mainstream now.
Okay.
And so NOW got started, and it was actually formed in October of 1966 in the basement or the community room of the Washington Post here. When we had meetings several days, I was present.
Oh.
And we formed NOW. So after we formed NOW, I began to play a double role, or to lead a double life. I would be at the EOC in the daytime doing my job,
mm-hmm.
and I would be seeing one thing after the other that the commission didn't do for women that I thought they should do. And at night, I would go to Mary Eastwood's home
mm-hmm.
or someone else's home, and I would draft a letter to the EOC based on what I had seen that day that they didn't do. And as I said, Mary was there, Phineas would be there, Carruthers Burgess could be there, Morex Simchick could be there. And we would say, why aren't you doing this, and why didn't you do that, and why didn't you do the other? And we would send to the EOC.
You wouldn't sign it, though?
I would sign it for NOW, not with my name.
Oh, okay. And did the EEOC know that you were going to these meetings?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I was sharing with these people confidential government information.
Okay. Let me just jump in with a small question. Is that why Graham wasn't reappointed, because he was stirring up the waters on this issue, or that no one knows?
I don't really know, but that's what we thought.
Okay.
I don't really know.
Okay.
But that's what we thought. I don't know.
You were drafting.
I'm still in touch with him.
Oh. Okay.
He's a very fine man.
Okay.
Why the EOC never questioned, how does this organization know what we're doing? It never came up. Nobody ever accused me of anything, nothing. So we did that. And meanwhile, NOW started to picket the EOC, and NOW brought lawsuits on classified advertising, because EOC had a Michigan is a Yiddish word meaning crazy
mm-hmm.
policy about classified advertising. And the EOC began to turn around. By the way, a big opponent to women's rights in the early days was Luther Holcomb.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to go through the list of commissioners you mentioned.
But,
Franklin Roosevelt Jr. wasn't in.
He was out of it.
Okay.
He was there. He was there a short period of time.
Okay.
And left, and he had nothing to do with anything. The only thing I ever remember about him was I was in his office shortly after the EOC was, shortly after I got there, and apparently his office had been redecorated, and he looked around, he said, look at this place, it looks like a French whorehouse. And that's the only thing I ever remember about FDR.
He went sailing a lot, I know that from
that I don't know. And then he was out of there in a very short period of time.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, who was the next chairman?
I have the list somewhere, but you've mentioned some of them.
Bill Brown came later.
Yeah, and Shulman was he chair for a
He term? Was chairman when he signed the meatpacking thing.
Oh, okay. All right, that's right. Okay. Yeah.
I like him now. I've seen him for dinner, and I think he's much nicer now than I thought he was at the time I worked there.
There was such a turnover of people. I know. Did the commissioners seem to be, I don't know if this is a right way of phrasing this question, but pro or anti-labor? For instance, William Brown, it seemed like unionists didn't like him.
I can't answer you because my emphasis was on women's rights,
right.
Not on labor.
Okay.
I don't know where they stood on labor.
Okay. So there's this important move that NOW has come into existence, and there are key people, including yourself, who are they have the inside track and they're able to lobby both personally and through now?
Well, I was the only one with the inside track at the OC.
Oh, okay, okay.
The other women were in government agencies, wherever they were.
Okay. How do you explain, finally, the EEOC toughening their guidelines? And was it 1969 and finally?
Because of what was going on.
Okay, this was the final?
This was because this was going on.
Okay. How did things work after 69? You said you were with the EEOC.
Till 73, actually.
Through 73, yeah. What
it took about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And to give you an idea of the change, Luther Holcomb, somewhere along the line, in the beginning, he was so opposed, he asked my boss, Charlie Duncan, to remove me from drafting the decision in the flight cabin attendants case because I was biased in favor of women. Now, what did that mean? The purpose of Title VII was to prevent discrimination against women. But he saw that as a bias and asked my boss to remove him from the case, to remove me from the case, which my boss did not do. I drafted those decisions. Sometime later, this guy, Luther Holcomb, took me out to dinner. And went out to lunch with him, and said he couldn't understand why he didn't have the credibility with women's groups that I did. And I sat behind him in the Congress when he went on a hearing and asked the Congress to take sex discrimination out of Title VII. This was after it was an act, okay? And I have stuff, he wrote letters to Lyndon Johnson against enforcement of the sex discrimination. This guy was a piece of work.
Why do you think he was so hostile,
he was a bigot altogether.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. He was bad. Bad news. And he was an old-time reverend. He was a minister.
Oh, this is a person from Texas.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. But he turned around when he saw which way the wind was blowing. Okay. And the other person who did it, who's, may he rest in peace, Herman Adelsberg, saw me toward the latter years of his life. And partially he would claim that I educated him on the issue, but I never did. He never changed his mind. He was a big opponent of women's rights, but towards the end of his life, he tried to say that he wasn't, and that he had two daughters, and whatnot and everything, but I remember, I have a very good memory for who was with us and who wasn't, and he was very much opposed, and it broke my heart because he was in a position of power. He was executive director.
Mm. Tell me again what your job, tell me your position at this time.
Okay. Initially, I was just a lawyer in the Office of the General Counsel.
Okay.
And somewhere along the line, I think I got a title called Director of Compliance Management. So I was head of a little section.
Okay. Now, I think I know what your answer was because you indicated this earlier, but at this point, the unions want to know about these complaints early on in the process, and they're asking for the complaints to be sent directly to the office in Washington or the international office. Were you in on any of this sort of?
No, except we had our confidentiality provisions in the statute, and I don't know. I think there was some deal worked out where we would do something if the union was named.
Okay.
If there was an allegation against the union, I think there was some kind of arrangement, but basically we were bound by confidentiality.
Did you sense that the perception by most EEOC staff members from the mid-60s to the early 70s towards organized labor became more hostile, less hostile, or it depended on who you were and how you viewed the labor movement?
I have to stress that you keep asking me about unions there, and that was not a focus, all right? The focus was discrimination against women or African Americans or whatnot, whether it was by unions or by somebody else. I don't remember much about unions. I don't remember ever any hostility towards unions, unless they were, now there was a problem with unions because of sex-segregated job classifications and seniority lines.
Okay.
And I think the unions were supporting that because they were big on seniority. And so some of the cases involved these sex-segregated seniority lines, which the unions supported, and so the commission went against them, but it had nothing to do with unions. Didn't matter who it was. I mean, they were opposing what we thought was the implementation of the law.
How about presidents during this time? LBJ, was there a sense that when they knew...
Kennedy was president for part of it.
Yeah. How would you have an opinion on rating Kennedy's administration, Johnson's, and Nixon's in terms of women's issues? Which one fared better, or?
I don't really know. There are statistics on this. The only thing I felt bad about when I worked at the Labor Board, I always felt bad that I was a couple of blocks away from the White House and no president ever came over and said, you know, hello, or made a tour of the building. Beyond that, I knew at the time, you know, I had my feelings at the time, but I've seen statistics that some presidents appointed more women than others who you might have thought of, so I don't think any of them were great. As far as women's rights, but somebody would have to look up the numbers on that.
Let me ask you about just briefly, because I don't know how the EEOC, and especially in its early years, related to the Office of Federal, what is it?
Contract Compliance Programs.
Yeah. Was there any debate at that point on merging those two?
No, not in the early days,
okay.
to my knowledge. What happened there, and I was to some extent involved in it, but my friend, Bunny Sandler, and Bunny Sandler was more with the Title VI, take it back. But I was involved in the initial executive order was 11246.
Okay.
And did not prohibit sex discrimination by federal government contractors and subcontractors. And I remember having a discussion with an African American man who might have been in charge of the OFCCP at the time about the inclusion of sex discrimination in it. And that took a while. And eventually it was changed to 11375, or 11375 amended 11246, I forget what it was, to include sex discrimination. Initially it did not. And that's what I remember about that. Bunny Sandler was solely responsible in these United States for getting the federal government to use I think it was Title VI or also 11375, I guess, to prohibit sex discrimination by colleges and universities and schools.
That would be the early 70s.
I don't know.
Yeah.
A little later, you know, a little bit later, because she came onto the scene a little bit later.
What is your, you left the EEOC in 73.
Right.
Well, I suppose I should start with when you left and maybe then go back. Why did you leave the EEOC?
I was Director of Compliance Management. Mm-hmm. And there was another section like that with another name, but we were like two groups in the same section. And this other guy was named George Darden. And he was an African American. And he never did anything but sleep at his desk. So then I was told that those two sections would be merged, which made sense,
mm-hmm.
and that George Darden would become head of it. And I asked why. And I did not get an answer. So then, and my impression was that he was getting it because he was African American and I was white.
Mm-hmm.
And this was under Bill Brown. And I think that's what started to happen then at the EOC. So, but even they couldn't give it to George Darden,
mm-hmm.
even though they wanted to give it to an African American.
Mm-hmm.
So the next thing I hear, they're giving it to a woman named Izzy Jenkins, who had trial experience. And they said they wanted someone with trial experience, which was interesting, but those sections didn't deal with trials.
Okay.
But she was African American. So they said she was going to come over from the Justice Department and be in charge of the two sections, but would I please train her in Title VII law, because she didn't know anything about it. So I said I would not, and that I would leave the agency. And under those conditions, that's why I left. I got another job and I left. Interesting coincidence or wrinkle. Now, I subsequently heard that Izzy Jenkins is a very nice woman. I have nothing against her.
Right.
But I started being a volunteer last week for the Montgomery County Department of Human Relations. And I was talking to the compliance director there who was training me. And we talked about the fact that if cases come and they have to do with the EOC, we send it to the Baltimore office of the EOC. And I asked who's in charge of that, because I figured it could be somebody I know from my EOC days, and he said, Izzy Jenkins. I said, oh my
God.
Right.
What is, you know, there's so many, I don't know, there are books, but there are articles on the ineffectiveness of the EEOC. And just it's sort of thinking about it in a broad sense, what do you see as its strengths and its weaknesses in that first decade in existence, the 65 to 73, or even if you left 75, because certainly you must have kept an eye on what was going on?
I've never left it. I'm always in touch with Al Golub, who was deputy executive director. The EOC and the formation of NOW were the central defining events of my life. That plus having my daughter. So that's not, women's rights is not something that you ever leave. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a cause.
Sure.
You don't leave that and it doesn't leave you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what else I do. Now, what were the strengths and what were the weaknesses? I believe, and I like to believe this, okay? It suits my psyche, that NOW and the other women's rights organizations and the EOC revolutionized not only this country but the world.
Mm-hmm.
It will never be the same again.
Mm-hmm.
We did that. We affected every woman in this country who was not even born then, and every man by affecting every woman. And I'm now interested globally. This year I went to China and I went to Israel, and both places I was involved in women's rights. So I'm interested now in the global aspect of this, but it's going around the world. And the EOC started it. I guess the main thing we did was, I spoke to you before and I said there was no such thing as women's rights
mm-hmm.
when the EOC opened for business. The main thing it did, with NOW also,
right.
And with other things in the society and in the culture in the time that fed into it, was to make women's rights an issue in this country. I mean, look at the last election, all these issues involving abortion and women,
mm-hmm.
everything. Years ago, you would mention a women's issue was a joke, it wasn't a political matter.
Mm-hmm.
So the main thing it did was bring to the consciousness of the United States and therefore the world the fact that there is such a thing as women's rights. Now, I don't delude myself that we started it. I know there was a women's rights movement in it. Culminated in the vote, and there were other women's rights movements, but basically for 40 years, from 1920 to 1960-ish, there wasn't any movement. It started again. So that's the main thing it did. It made women think differently about themselves. I mean, every young girl you talk about today, she thinks it's nothing unusual. You say to a young girl, what do you want to be? She says, well, I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
These girls don't know that years ago, all they could be was a teacher, or a sales girl, or a nurse, and they all wanted to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And they just take it as a matter of course, but when I hear that, I know how revolutionary that is.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main thing that was done by the EOS and these other elements working together. The weakness, well, I guess the case-by-case approach, you really need more class action type of stuff. Probably that's a weakness. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Have you, just to sort of get the biographical strain, you left in 73. Did you stay?
Meanwhile, I'd gotten married.
You left in 73 and got married?
I got married in 1970.
Okay. And when you left in 73, did you?
And I had a daughter.
Okay, so you didn't stay in government, paid government work at that point?
No, I went to a corporation, GTE.
Okay.
In Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, okay. And stayed with them for?
Until 19... I stayed with them 8.5 years. So till the fall of 1981. I started with them June 18th, 1973, and I left the end of 81.
Oh, okay. And then moved back to Washington?
No, then I went to TRW in Cleveland. And I was with them until September of 84.
Okay.
And I was fired there.
Then you came back to
Because I wanted to do EEO, for which I was hired, and they didn't want me to do it. And then it took me a year and a quarter to get a job, and I came back to Washington in beginning of 86.
Well, I'm just trying to think. I know there'll be questions I have forgotten to ask. That always happens when I get into this sort of interview situation. You were a member of NOW. Have you been
a founding member of NOW?
Okay. And
I dropped out.
Okay.
And recently, about a year or two ago, I joined again.
Okay.
And then I got mad at them and dropped out again. But I've been involved in other women's rights things.
Okay.
But I'm not active in NOW anymore.
What do you think is the challenge in the next 10 years, both in terms of equal employment opportunity for women and sort of the larger issues of feminism?
There are still things to be done here, like the Equal Rights Amendment. I think the major issues today are really involve men and women, and that is how you balance career and family.
Mm-hmm.
We've made a lot of changes as far as women going into the workforce. I think women still bear predominantly the burden of running the home and raising the children, and there needs to be more change in that area. To me, the big challenge, as I mentioned to you earlier, is now global.
Mm-hmm.
The Washington Post last year did a 5-part series on called something like Third World, Second Class, about the horrific status of women in some third world countries. There's an awful lot needs to be done in the rest of the world. My interest these days is in the rest of the world.
I know there was the International Labor Organization in the 50s and other international groups. Did you get a sense in those early days of the second wave of feminism, as is known, the founding of NOW, that people were looking to other countries, European countries and other places? Or do you see that as something a little more recent?
No, as far as I'm concerned, it's more recent. And we're not, what do you mean looking to Europe?
Well, communicating with people, not taking hints from them necessarily, but forming coalitions or attending international meetings.
I think of that as more recent and as not having to do with the ILO.
Did something I forgot to ask earlier.
I think a lot had to do with they started to have these, I plan to go to China in 95 for the 4th International Conference on Women.
Okay.
So there was this one in Nairobi. I think it started with that kind of stuff, you know.
Okay.
They had that meeting in Nairobi I know about, and maybe some others, and I think that's when this kind of stuff more began to start. It's more recent.
Okay. I forgot to ask you this earlier, actually. We mentioned Win Newman, and so did you know him?
Yes,
okay.
Win's a friend of mine for
ages,
and he is the outstanding person in the United States in the comparable worth area.
Okay.
He's brought all the leading cases in comparable worth.
So his benefits have been positive, they haven't been middle of the ground? Or
absolutely,
okay.
Always favorable to women's rights.
Okay. Okay.
And liberal, he comes out of the labor movement.
Yeah. As pay equity, was that an issue in the late 60s, early 70s?
It was an issue when I had a couple of cases that raised it. One I remember was called Piccadilly something or other.
Mm.
We had a couple of cases in the early days. It was a difficult issue. When I was there, we didn't do much with it. Much didn't happen. But Wynne was very active in getting that thing, but it hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't been successful with it.
Am I forgetting anything? I'm sure I am, but I mean, it sounds like
I don't know, if you read the material,
the
whatever you may have forgotten,
yeah.
If you read the material I gave you,
okay.
I think you'll have it.
Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate
Pleasure.
It. And thanks again.
Okay.
This is the end of Side 2 interview on November 23rd, 1993 with Sonia Pressman Fuentes in Potomac, Maryland.